Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, EQMM's editor. This month we feature a collaborative effort of two Mystery Writers of America grandmasters, Bill Pranzini and Marcia Muller. The story has its origin in a series originally begun by Bill Pranzini, but its star characters are a male and female detecting team, so perhaps it seemed natural for Marcia Muller eventually to collaborate in writing this series with her husband. Fans will be glad to know that the authors recently signed a new three-book contract for the historical series, which is set in 1890 San Francisco. The first book is due out in 2012. Meanwhile, here's their story, The Chatelaine Bag, from the June 2011 EQMM. The part of John Quincannon, former Secret Service agent, is read by Bill Pranzini. The part of Sabina Carpenter, former Pinkerton agent, is read by Marcia Muller.
The Chatelaine Bag by Marcia Muller and Bill Pranzini. Quincannon. Handbags. Reticules. Bah! Perhaps he was a man of low tastes, as Sabina had accused him of being, but the appeal of such fancy antique gewgaws escaped him. He could understand why well-to-do women from Rincon Hill and Knob Hill might find reticules through the ages of some interest. A certain type of thief, too, given the declared value of the exhibition's centerpiece, a bejeweled chatelaine bag that had once belonged to Marie Antoinette. The remote possibility of theft was the reason he and Sabina had been hired to protect the confounded collection. But men in general? Why would a respectable gent worth the name give two hoots about carryalls that had belonged to ladies 100 and 200 years ago? And yet, fully one-third of the visitors to the Rayburn Art Gallery over the past 2 days had been men. Some dragged there by their wives, no doubt, but the rest were a puzzle he had no interest in solving. From his vantage point between the front entrance and the wine and liquor buffet, Quincannon again scanned the dwindling crowd before the long exhibit table at the inner wall. It was nearly 7 o'clock of a dark February night, closing time for this second day of the 3-day exhibition. Electric light from old gasoliers fitted with incandescent bulbs made the large room bright as day, and his observations that much easier. The only familiar faces other than Sabina's belonged to Marcel Lebeau, assistant curator of the Louvre Museum in Paris, the man in charge of the collection and their client, Andrew Rayburn, the gallery owner, and his two clerks, Holloway and Eldridge. Quincannon had recognized only a few visitors since yesterday's opening, none of those suspicious. Every professional thief, yegg, and miscreant in San Francisco and environs was known to him, and none had dared show his or her face. Not that this was a surprise. Any Barbary Coast or East Bay scruff caught snaffling reticule, even one bristling with small diamonds and rubies, would be the butt of jokes by his fellows for the rest of his days. Besides which, what chance did even the cleverest of them have of managing such a swipe? The exhibition was well watched by Sabina and himself, as well as by Rayburn and the two clerks, during the hours it was open. And after closing, Lebeau and Rayburn carefully locked the collection away in the gallery vault, which was not only as close to being burglar-proof as any manufactured safe, but was under guard by an armed watchman. Day watchmen were what he and Sabina were. Necessary, he supposed, but nonetheless mere window dressing. The job paid moderately well, and Carpenter and Quincannon Professional Detective Services was otherwise between clients. But by Godfrey, it offered no challenge whatsoever to a sleuth of John Quincannon's considerable talents. Dull standabout work of the sort any average or sub-average fly cop can handle. Sabina felt differently, of course. The 2 dozen or so ancient items on display fascinated her, by her own admission, and she seemed to find guard duty in a post-street gallery stimulating, because it allowed her to mingle with some of the city's hoi polloi. Women. Marvelous creatures, but he could never understand them. Sabina was a constant mystery to him. So was her infuriating and inexplicable refusal to have anything to do with him of a romantic nature, despite his persistence and what he considered to be honorable intentions. Quincannon looked across at where she was standing next to the food buffet. If you could call cheese, crackers, nuts, skewered pieces of fruit, and strange-looking canapés food. She wore a Nile green embroidered silk frock that accented her handsome figure. The rather large, plain handbag she carried had a .22-caliber pistol tucked inside. He sighed and fluffed his freebooter's beard. He wouldn't have admitted it, but he was feeling a touch sorry for himself, and not a little jealous of the smile she kept bestowing on the well-dressed gents who stopped to speak to her. The person her smile was favoring at the moment was a corpulent middle-aged man whose expression, at least to Quincannon's jaundiced eye, was one of ill-concealed lust. Reticules through the ages. Bah and double bah.
Sabina. Sabina smiled at the large man whose large corporations strained the buttons of his lacy white shirt. That one's never missed a meal, she thought. The words her late mother had been prone to utter in embarrassingly loud tones. And every one of those meals seemed to have expanded his stomach, while leaving the rest of him more or less normal size. Then she chided herself for being unkind. After all, the man had yet to partake of the buffet since his arrival a few minutes earlier. Perhaps he was on a diet. Nonetheless, smiling in return, he chose to compliment the table. A sumptuous buffet, is it not? Very nice. The corpulent man persisted. Allow me to introduce myself. Thaddeus Backer, of the Sacramento Backers. Perhaps you've heard of me. Of course, she said, although she had not. Sabina Carpenter. A most excellent exhibit, too, he added. Yes, are you a connoisseur, Mr. Backer? Of handbags and reticules? No. No, merely an art lover and a student of history in all its forms. And you, Miss Carpenter, connoisseur? Mrs. Carpenter. Yes, you might say that. Backer bowed, rather clumsily, given his bulging midsection. If you'll excuse me, I believe I'll have another look at the exhibition. He favored her with another smile and moved ponderously toward the display table. Behind Sabina at the food buffet stood a gentleman with a tortoise-shell pince-nez, squinting through its lens at a brick of Stilton cheese as if he found it suspect. Harumph! He repeatedly exclaimed, as though something were lodged in his throat. At the other end of the long table, a group of ladies clad in slimmed-down dresses of the 90s, bustles, thank the Lord, were no longer in fashion, milled about, nibbling canapes and talking. She looked away from the well-dressed crowd and again let her gaze wander over to the bags on display. Her favorites were the chatelaine bags, reticules that in olden times had hung from an ornamental hook on the jeweled girdles of ladies of high station and contained useful household items. Made of beadwork or silver or gold, many were set with semi-precious or precious gems, such as the diamond and ruby encrusted bag that Marie Antoinette had worn at Versailles. The Antoinette bag was wide and long, 6 by 10 inches, with a rigid gold frame and clasp. It was the jewel of this exhibition, valued at several $1,000. Across the room, she spied her partner near the wine and liquor buffet. Something of an irony, because he had renounced demon rum after a tragic accident during his days with the United States Secret Service. With his luxuriant freebooter's beard and his gray sack coat, matching waistcoat and striped trousers, he cut a handsome figure. The four in hand was a bit garish, but then he could be flamboyant when the mood struck him. Still, he was finally turned out. Not that Sabina would flatter him by telling him so. Any such praise would only encourage him in his pursuit of her, set him to spouting the poetry he so loved, and importuning for opportunities to dine together. She had been a widow too long for such romantic nonsense. Her husband, like she, had worked as a Pinkerton agent in Denver, and had been foully murdered several years ago in the line of duty. Besides, she valued John too much as a friend and business partner to welcome any sort of dalliance. Although, at times, being well aware of the pleasures of the flesh, she wondered. None of that now. You are here to observe and protect, not wool gather. She moved closer to the display to once more marvel at the Antoinette chatelaine bag. It was suspended from a hook in its blue velvet display case, jewels winking in the soft electric light. Such a history it had, seized by French revolutionists and paraded through the streets of Paris as an example of the monarchy's excesses. Lost for two decades, it had resurfaced in the possession of a descendant of a minor revolutionary who donated it to the Louvre Museum. And there it had been permanently displayed until Bernard La Follette, curator, joined with the curators from museums in Florence and Venice to organize this exhibition and bring it to selected American cities under the guidance of Marcel Lebeau. The gallery venue was especially favorable, small, secure, and most of the visitors were known to Andrew Rayburn, the owner. Far better here than a large exhibition hall with many entrances and exits, or even the local museums with their dark nooks and crannies. Yes, the reticules should be quite safe here. Mr. Lebeau's hiring of the Carpenter and Quincannon agency had been an unnecessary precaution, perhaps, but Sabine was glad of it, even if John groused at a job he considered beneath his talents. The opportunity to view such a splendid collection was a pleasure, and the fee was excellent. She looked over the crowd again, then crossed the room to speak with John. "All seems well," she said in low tones. "Another day without incident or suspicious characters among the viewers." He nodded and then asked in tones that bore an undercurrent of jealousy, "You and that fat gent appeared to find each other amusing." "Amusing? All smiles, both of you. Who is he?" "Mr. Thaddeus Backer of the Sacramento Backers." "Whoever they are, what did he want?" "Why, I assume what men always want." John narrowed his eyes at her. "And what is that?" "A pleasant conversation, of course," she said serenely, and went back to her station near the food buffet.
Quincannon. The number of visitors had thinned to less than a dozen men and women, all of them grouped in the middle of the room between the two buffets. Quincannon consulted his stemwinder. 6 minutes until closing. And 7 o'clock would arrive not a moment too soon. He was weary of the day's long-standing vigil, and in need of a genuine meal such as the unparalleled seafood fare at the Cobweb Palace at Meg's Wharf. Perhaps Sabina... "Excuse me, young man." A rather overdressed middle-aged matron had sidled up next to him. "Yes, madam," he said through an artificial smile. "Are you an employee of this establishment? Why do you ask?" "You have been standing in this same place the entire time I've been here, looking at everything except the exhibition. Are you an employee?" "After a fashion." "That is not an answer. I don't believe you are. I have been a patron of Rayburn's for many years, and I've never seen you before." She waved a lorgnette at him as if it were a miniature sword. "I find you suspicious." Quincannon managed to maintain his professional smile. "Do you indeed? Well, just who are you?" "A gentleman of industry." "A what?" "Bosh! You look like a thief." "And you look like a bulldog," he thought. "Have you ever seen a thief, madam?" "Yes, and he looked exactly like you, though I must say his attire was of much better quality." This altered his smile into a ferocious glower. "Madam, if you..." And all the lights went out. The sudden darkness was nearly absolute. There were no street lamps in the immediate vicinity outside the gallery. The only light that penetrated, and only faintly, came from the lamps of hansoms, carriages, and one of those infernal, horse-frightening motorized contraptions passing on Post Street. The bulldog emitted a startled sound that was more bark than shriek. Voices rose querulously. There was a confused milling about. Quincannon's reaction was immediate. 3 long strides took him to the front entrance. He barred it with his body and outflung arms, and shouted in a stentorian voice, "Stand clear of the doors! No one is allowed to leave!" Sabina had moved just as quickly and instinctively. Her voice rose out of the darkness. "Rear doorway secure!" Andrew Rayburn's came next. "Remain calm, ladies and gentlemen, remain calm. I'll soon have the lights back on." The others in the room quieted and grew still. Someone brushed up against Quincannon, either by accident or in an attempt to exit. A none too gentle shove brought instant retreat. A lucifer scratched and flared, then a brighter flame that came from a flint lighter. In the flickering glow, the faces of the dozen or so people appeared like masks of shadow. Quincannon squinted toward the reticules through the ages display. No one was in close proximity to it except George Eldridge, one of Rayburn's clerks. The sudden extinguishing of the lights might have been accidental. Such blackouts were not uncommon in this new age of electricity. But Quincannon distrusted coincidence whenever the possibility of nefarious activity was afoot, the more so when something like this happened at such a convenient time. He pressed his back more tightly against the doors, the fingers of his right hand touching the butt of the Navy Colt concealed inside his coat. No one made any effort to push past him while the blackout lasted, a period of no more than 2 minutes. But when the lights came on again, "The Marie Antoinette bag! It's gone!" The outcry came from Eldridge, who stood pointing at the reticules through the ages display. Even from a distance, Quincannon could see that the blue velvet centerpiece case was empty. He bit back a richly inventive and sulfurous oath, muttered instead, "Hell and damn!" His scowl was one of malignant ferocity. Another babble of voices had followed the clerk's pronouncement. Most of the people were grouped together in the center of the room, all except for Holloway and the corpulent gent, who stood off by himself, looking frightened and twitching his fingers across the front of his corporation. Marcel Lebeau and Andrew Rayburn stood next to Sabina at the rear doorway, both men gesticulating wildly. She said something to Lebeau that resulted in a violent headshake, after which the Frenchman turned, spied Quincannon, and came rushing over to him with Rayburn at his heels. The Frenchman was a tall, spare gent with elegantly tonsured silver hair. The gallery owner, by contrast, was a fussy little man with a fussy little black mustache. Lebeau still waved his arms, his saturnine face mottled with a mixture of outrage and anxiety. "The Chatelaine bag is missing, stolen." "So I understand." "Sans peeps de diables! Do something, monsieur. You were hired to prevent such a thing from happening." "Which neither Mrs. Carpenter nor I could very well do in a blacked-out room full of people." "Yes, yes, but the Marie Antoinette, the Marie Antoinette." One of Lebeau's flailing hands narrowly missed Quincannon's nose. "The gendarmes, the police, we must summon them immediately." "The police? Faugh!" The present regime was as corrupt and incompetent as any in the city's history. Should the bluecoats be brought in and one happen to stumble across the missing bag, like as not he would steal it himself. "There's no need for the police," Quincannon said, "when you have the finest detective west of the Mississippi River, if not the entire nation, already on the premises." "Eh? Who?" Quincannon's glower grew even more malignant. "John Quincannon, naturally, at your service." Rayburn said, "Yes, well, then do something, for heaven's sake." "I have been doing something, guarding this door." "No one slipped past you before you took up your position, you're sure?" "Positive. Nor did anyone slip past Mrs. Carpenter, I take it." "Only me. I went into the storeroom just after she took up her position, to find out what happened to the lights." "Could you tell if anyone else was in the storeroom?" "I didn't see anyone when the lights were restored." "What caused them to go out?" "A fuse had come loose. I screwed it back in." "Come loose by itself? Not likely." "Is the rear entrance locked?" "Yes. I made sure of it before I returned to the gallery." "Who else has a key besides you?" "No one. It's in my vest pocket." "Bully," Quincannon said. "What? Bully? What the devil's the matter with you, Quincannon? Don't you understand that someone has made off with the most valuable Chatelaine bag in the collection?" "Calm yourself, Mr. Rayburn. No one has made off with it." "Eh?" Lebeau said. "What's that you say?" "Everyone who was in the gallery before the lights went out is still here," Quincannon said. "Ergo, both the thief and the missing reticule are still here. We'll soon have both in hand."
Sabina. After Andrew Rayburn locked the front doors, he and Monsieur Lebeau gathered all the guests and the two clerks together in the middle of the gallery and revealed her and John's identities. There were exclamations of surprise. The man with the pince-nez still seemed to be trying to dislodge an obstruction in his throat. A series of harumphs overrode the other voices. a dowager with great sausage-shaped curls, topped by a feather-strewn hat, said in a disbelieving voice. Detectives, a woman, and this man? John glowered at her. And why not, madame? You still look like a thief to me. Mr. Rayburn, are you sure he isn't the one who pinched the missing bag? Mutters and grumbles followed this. John, who had little patience at the best of times, looked as if he would like to strangle the woman. Sabina put a restraining hand on his arm, and he took a step forward. The gallery owner sought to reassure everyone that not only was John innocent of the theft, but that Carpenter and Quincannon Professional Detective Services was the city's most reputable detective agency. His words were met with more mutters and dubious expressions, none more skeptical than the sausage-curled dowagers. It was John who restored order by taking control of the situation. He did this in typical John Quincannon fashion by expanding his chest and shouting in a voice loud enough to rattle the window glass. Quiet! Quiet, I say! The words broke no argument, and there was none. Whoever took the confounded bag is still in this room. So is the bag itself. A careful search will turn it up. A gentleman in a derby hat said meekly, Do you intend to search each of us? If necessary. Outrageous, this from the dowager. I refuse to be treated like a common thief. Whether or not you're a thief, madame, common or otherwise, remains to be seen. What? How dare you? Tact was sometimes as lacking in John as patience. Sabina hurriedly interceded. And if a search of your person is necessary, it will be done privately and with the utmost prudence. No one will be unduly inconvenienced. I, for one, have no objection to being searched, Thaddeus Backer said. No innocent person should have. Just so, Mr. Backer. John ordered everyone to move over to the wall behind the food buffet and stay there in a group. When this was done, he, Sabina, LeBeau, and Rayburn held a brief conference on the opposite side of the gallery. I don't see how searching everyone will turn up the bag, Rayburn said. Surely the thief wouldn't have it on his person. And why not? Sabina answered John's question. You didn't pay much attention to it, but it's too large to be hidden in men's or women's clothing. She held out her hands in an approximation of the chatelaine's size. The clasp alone would make it virtually impossible to conceal. The Frenchman concurred, mais oui, quite impossible. Everyone will have to be searched nonetheless. Perhaps the thief have hidden it somewhere in this room with the idea of returning for it later. Or in the storeroom or my office, the gallery owner added. Not likely in either of those places, Mr. Rayburn, John said. It's a certainty no one left this room while the lights were out, nor has left it since you put them on again. Yes, that's right. John fluffed his beard and smacked his hands together. We'll search the lot of them now, he said, and have done with that first. Sooner or later, in one place or another, we'll find your Marie Antoinette. We had better find it, Monsieur Quincannon, LeBeau said portentously. We had better.
Quincannon. While Sabina watched over the women, Quincannon searched each of the four male guests and the two gallery employees in Rayburn's private office. LeBeau then insisted that his and Rayburn's persons be searched, and when that was done, that Quincannon submit to a search as well. The Frenchman's pat-down technique was more thorough than Quincannon felt was necessary, but he offered no complaint. The chatelaine bag remained missing. Sabina took her turn with the five women guests, the blasted bulldog still outraged and making dire threats of a lawsuit against all parties concerned. If a muzzle had been close at hand, Quincannon would cheerfully have used it to still her yapping. None of the women possessed the bag either. So it must be hidden somewhere in the gallery, either by design, in which case the thief believed himself to be more clever than he was, or because he had realized he couldn't get away with his crime and stashed the bag to avert detection. He would be unmasked and snaffled in any case. No thief had yet outwitted John Quincannon, and no thief ever would. Guests and employees were herded into the storeroom, with Sabina again on guard, after which the three men commenced a careful exploration of the gallery. Every possible hiding place was examined. Nooks and crannies, the undersides of the display table, chairs, and pedestals used to exhibit sculptures, the backs of paintings mounted on the walls, and the food, bottles, plates, and glassware on the two buffets. Quincannon even went so far as to test the walls and floor for possible hidey holes, of which he found none. The bag was not there. "Zut alors," Lebeau said in exasperation when they were finished. "C'est incroyable. You are certain, Monsieur Quincannon, that the thief could not have left this room during the blackout?" "Unless he or she has the power to walk through solid walls, I am." "Then where is the Marie Antoinette?" Quincannon had no idea where the blasted bag was, not that he would ever have admitted it to the Frenchman or anyone else. "No one will leave these premises until we find it," he said with more conviction than he felt. He went to the storeroom door and gestured to Sabina to come out. "Mrs. Carpenter," he said formally when she joined them, "do you agree that there are two people involved in the theft?" Lebeau and Rayburn both seemed surprised at the question, but only until Sabina answered it. "I do," she said, "one to loosen the fuse at a prearranged time, the other to lift the bag from the display table." "Is it likely one of the guests would know where the fuse box is located and be able to find it by matchlight in a dark room?" "Not likely at all." Rayburn's thin mustache twitched. "Are you saying the accomplice, if there is one of my employees?" "Holloway or Eldridge, yes." "How long have they worked for you?" "Eldridge for 4 years, Holloway for just under one. But," Sabina said, "I kept a watchful eye on the storage room door, of course, but not every second. One or the other could easily have slipped through." "And hidden and then returned after Mr. Rayburn," Quincannon said. "Yes, but not before. Did you notice where Holloway and Eldridge were standing prior to the blackout? My attention was diverted by that dowager bulldog. They were both near the display table on the side nearest the storeroom door. When the lights came on, Eldridge was in front of the table, apparently the first to notice the Antoinette bag was missing. And Holloway?" Sabina didn't answer immediately. She seemed to be cogitating, as if something had just occurred to her. Whatever it was, she chose not to share it. After a few seconds, she said, "Holloway? I don't know. I didn't see him." "I did," Rayburn said. "He was at my side just after I came in from the storeroom. I remember because he spoke my name." The Frenchman confirmed this. "Oui, I heard him as well." "Could he have followed you in?" Quincannon asked Rayburn. "I suppose he could have, if he'd been hiding somewhere near the door." Elias Holloway was summoned to join them. He was about Rayburn's size, with delicate features and fair hair. He had a habit of clasping his long-fingered hands at his waist. Now he stood rubbing them together in a nervous fashion. But his gaze was steady and his posture one of defensive innocence. He vehemently denied having been in the storeroom. "I was at the wall behind the display table," he said, "from just before the blackout until the light was restored." "Who else was near the table before?" Quincannon demanded. "George Eldridge, moving about in front."
"Just him?"
"In the immediate vicinity, yes."
"And you have no idea who snatched the bag?"
"None. None at all." Quincannon had a sharp eye for facial expressions and body movements, a sharp ear for nuances of speech. It was the rare miscreant, male or female, who could dupe him successfully. He drew himself up and loomed over the small man, fixing him with a basilisk glare. "You lie, Holloway," he said. "I know you're guilty. We all know it. Confess and identify your confederate, and perhaps Monsieur Lebeau will be inclined to be lenient with you." "But yes, I will," the Frenchman said. "My only concern is the recovery of the Marie Antoinette." But the clerk foolishly maintained a misguided faith in his partner and the hope for his share of the spoils. "You can't intimidate me," he said. "I had nothing to do with the theft. Nothing, do you understand? And you can't prove I did." Quincannon resisted an impulse to hoist up the little man and shake him until his bones rattled. Such action might have the desired effect, but he had built his reputation as a premier sleuth on his mental prowess, not on the use of force in front of witnesses. If Holloway refused to cooperate, so be it. The truth of the matter would be discovered in other ways, and soon. Failure was not a word in Quincannon's lexicon. He sent Holloway back to wait with the others, and summoned George Eldridge, a few years older and several pounds heavier. Eldridge was cooperative, but had nothing of importance to relate. He had stopped near the far corner of the table when the room went dark, he said, and remained there until it was lighted again. He couldn't recall if Holloway had been in the room or not when he spied the empty blue velvet case. His attention had been riveted on that. Nor could he say who else might have been close enough to the table to snag the chatelaine bag in the darkness. "What now, Monsieur Quincannon?" Lebeau asked when Eldridge had left their company. "What now, eh?" Quincannon, despite his silent bluster, was nonplussed for one of the few times in his life. He was still struggling for a suitable response when Sabina stirred and put a hand on his arm. She had remained quiet the entire time Holloway and Eldridge were being questioned, evidently lost in thought. Now she seemed more animated than ever, her dark blue eyes bright. "John," she said, "there's another person to be questioned, and without delay." "Yes? Who would that be?" "Mr. Thaddeus Backer of the Sacramento Backers." "Why? Do you think he knows something useful?" "Fetch him, please." "I repeat, why?" "Because he ate nothing from the food buffet prior to the blackout, because his neck is slender and so are his arms and legs, and because of his frilly white shirt. Now will you please fetch him?" For a moment Quincannon wondered if she had gone daft, but Sabina's tone was commanding, and when she spoke in such a fashion it was usually for a well-considered reason. Without further comment, he went and fetched the corpulent gent, who seemed as puzzled as he was by the summons. "I don't know what I can tell you," he said. I don't know anything at all about the theft." Sabina studied him for several seconds, then nodded crisply as if in confirmation of what she was thinking. "Don't you, Mr. Backer?" "I just said so, haven't I?" "Where were you when the blackout ended?" "Why, I don't recall exactly. By the liquor buffet, I believe." "No, you were standing near the wall beyond the Reticules Through the Ages display." "Was I?" "You were," Quincannon said. "I saw you there myself when the lights came on, just turning around and fussing with your shirt front." "Not exactly fussing," Sabina said. "What he was actually doing was refastening one of the buttons." "What of it?" Backer drew himself up. "Are you suggesting I stole the Marie Antoinette reticule and hid it inside my shirt?" "Stole it, yes. Hid it, yes. But not inside your shirt." "The accusation is preposterous. Mr. Quincannon here searched me himself. If the bag was in my clothing, he would have found it." "It wasn't and isn't in your clothing, Mr. Backer." "Then what do you..." To Quincannon's open-mouthed astonishment, Sabina suddenly punched Thaddeus Backer in the stomach with all her might.
Sabina, her closed fist must have sunk 2 inches into Backer's midriff, yet the man's only reaction was a small, startled grunt, thus confirming her suspicion and justifying her bold action. No genuinely fat man could have absorbed such a violent blow without indications of hurt. Rayburn gasped, and Lebeau exclaimed, "Mon Dieu!" But John understood immediately. "False, by Godfrey! A false corporation!" Backer realized the game was up and made a clumsy attempt to flee. John tripped him, pounced on top, and tore open the man's shirt to reveal a padded, convex mound wrapped in an elasticized garment resembling a woman's corset. A false corporation cunningly made so it would look and feel genuine when the clothing that covered it was searched. The corset-like garment fit tightly, but not so tightly it couldn't be pulled up along one side, which John quickly proceeded to do. A moment later, he removed the chatelaine bag from among wads of cotton padding inside and held it up for all to see. A good deal of confusion followed. Monsieur Lebeau seized the bag, examined it, and then, with a Gallic flourish, he threw his arms around Sabina and bestowed a kiss on each cheek. John glowered at this, but said nothing. He and Rayburn were busy lifting a weakly struggling Thaddeus Backer to his feet. Some of the guests had spilled out of the storeroom to look on, chattering in excited voices. Holloway, realizing his partner had been caught, made a foolish attempt to escape through the rear door. Eldridge and the man in the pince-nez halted and held him until he could be locked away in Rayburn's office with Backer. Eldridge was then sent to summon the police. It was 2 hours before the Bluecoats finished their officious duties and allowed everyone to leave. Two facts resulted from their interrogation of the culprits. Thaddeus Backer's real name was Horace Bean, and he was indeed from Sacramento, where he had twice been arrested on suspicion of jewel theft, and Elias Holloway was his brother-in-law. John remained uncharacteristically silent the whole time, speaking only when spoken to and avoiding Sabina's eye. She knew why, of course. He was pouting because she had upstaged him by solving the puzzle before he could. Sometimes working with him was akin to walking a tight wire. His pride and his conceit were considerable and often justified, but also easily bruised. He was far more vulnerable and insecure than he would ever admit. He would also never admit she was his equal as a detective, which of course she was, and on the occasions when she outsleuthed him, he found ways to rationalize her success, as he did in the hansom cab on the way from Post Street to her flat on Russian Hill, when he finally broke his brooding silence. "A woman's eye," he said. "Pardon?" "A woman has an eye for such details as whether or not a man eats from a buffet and the size of his neck and if one of his shirt buttons has been open. That's why you were able to deduce the hiding place of the bag before I did." "I'm sure that's so." She tried not to smile. "I would have come to the same conclusion eventually." "I'm sure you would have." "As a matter of fact, my mind had already begun to work along those lines. And such a nimble mind it is. We both know there is no better detective west of the Mississippi than John Quincannon." He said nothing, but in the glow from the side lamp, she could see that he was his old preening self again. "A woman's work is never done," she thought, and smiled her secret smile.
The Chatelaine Bag is copyrighted by Marsha Muller and Bill Pronzini. Music for this podcast is an unattributed performance of The Entertainer by Scott Joplin, made available through Wikimedia Commons. Mixing and sound editing for the podcast were done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more exciting mystery and crime stories, by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.